This is an ABC Radio National podcast, and we have many more to choose from, which you can hear details about after this program. But right now, we hope you enjoy this podcast.
There are very few philosophical page-turners, books by philosophers so exciting that they keep you up at night. But one of them, I think, is the autobiography of the English philosopher R.G. Collingwood.
He's a very angry, ill person, and he wants to distinguish himself intellectually, and so he pretty much alienates himself from philosophers, from archaeologists, educationalists. He pretty much burns his bridges in multiple directions.
Hello and welcome to the Philosopher's Zone. I'm Alan Saunders. In 1939, when he wrote his autobiography and burnt all those bridges, Robin George Collingwood was 50 and within 4 years of his death. It's the bitter work of a philosopher and historian and archaeologist who seems to want it known that he was always an outsider. But hey, he was Wainfleet Professor of Metaphysical Philosophy at the University of Oxford and a Fellow of the British Academy, so he wasn't exactly a lone voice in the wilderness. The autobiography is also an attempt, though, to set down the ideas that he thought he might not live to bring to fruition. And they're exciting ideas, I think, about the nature of history and the way we look at the world. As I found out when I talked about Collingwood to Marnie Hughes Warrington, Associate Professor in the Department of Modern History at Macquarie University. He is, I said to her, a man whom it's rather difficult to fit into the history of 20th century English language philosophy.
I think that's a really beautiful way of introducing Collingwood, because he doesn't fit the mould very well at all. He's a man of many eclectic tastes and talents, and that ranges not only from his archaeology but to his philosophy as well. In terms of his antecedents, there's what Collingwood says about himself and there's what everybody else says about Collingwood. Collingwood liked to think of himself as a lone voice in the wilderness. In his autobiography, he talked about himself very much as a man out of his time, that he was persecuted by the realists at Oxford, that he felt that times had changed and he had no place in Oxford. But I don't think we need necessarily believe what Collingwood said about himself. He also tried, in a way, to alienate himself from earlier new idealists, and he's often connected with new idealists such as T.H. Green. He believed that people like Green and Bosanquet were a bit ahistorical in their thinking, and he wanted to not only talk more about rationality in philosophy, but he wanted to historicize philosophy as well. And for that reason, and his dislike of the kind of ahistorical realism that he saw about him, he presented himself very much as an isolated philosophical figure.
And you mentioned in passing there his archaeology, and we should say that this wasn't just a hobby, was it? It wasn't just something he did at weekends. He made substantial contributions to archaeology, to the history of Roman Britain and so on.
Very definitely, and that's reflected very much in his upbringing. His father, William Gershom Collingwood, was a Ruskin secretary, moved the entire family to the Lake District. Collingwood was raised in the Lake District. At the age of 5, Collingwood wrote his first archaeological guide to Hard Knott Castle, and it's all beautifully handwritten, telling the visitor how to experience Hard Knott. His father took him on digs, and so from a very early age, he experienced the hands-on pleasure of archaeology. In later life, he viewed himself not as talented as an artist as his father. His father published books on Celtic crosses of Northumbria, very talented artist. Collingwood himself published on Roman Britain. He really got people to think about the function of Hadrian's Wall in new ways, and he also introduced techniques in archaeology that are still used today, such as plastering objects in order to remove them from the ground hole. So he's a man of great technical prowess, as well as a man that's thinking about the past in really interesting ways.
Well, let's look at his philosophy, and let's begin by what he thought a philosophical inquiry was. And the take-home message here seems to be that philosophy is a second-order inquiry and it reflects on first order inquiries. So perhaps you could tell us what a first order inquiry is that philosophy is reflecting on.
Sure. There are a range of first order inquiries that he talks about in books ranging from Specula Mentis from 1924 right through to the end of his life. He talks about such things as artistic activity, historical activity, and these are what he calls scientific activities. These are highly organised, methodologically sound ways of going about understanding the world in which we're highly competent in what we do. We produce papers and books that are highly technically competent. But the problem with these ways of thinking about the world, he thought, was that they really didn't get to an understanding of the presuppositions that were shaping those very activities, or indeed understanding that the presuppositions that shape those activities changed over time. And so a higher order activity was in a way needed to reflect back on those activities, to identify them as, in a sense, historically located and embedded activities.
Now, when you talk about presuppositions, he uses the phrase absolute presupposition. And this is what? This is the unchallenged and probably inarticulated assumptions upon which a science or any other form of first order activity proceeds.
That's correct. He's actually got a really lovely phrase where he talks about us being, quote, ticklish in our presuppositions, and an absolute presupposition just is. It's something that really shapes what we are, but if we start to dig away at it, we become uncomfortable with the sense of who we are, because it really forces us to ask really fundamental questions about who we are. Now, there are absolute presuppositions and there are relative presuppositions, and his belief is that most of the time we're handling relative presuppositions, but he wants us to, you know, engage in an act of self-tickling and identify these absolute presuppositions as well.
There's a phrase which is hideously popular these days, which normally takes the form of saying we've got to subvert the dominant paradigm. And the word paradigm used in this case comes from the American historian and philosopher, good historian, questionable philosopher of science, Thomas Kuhn, and his notion was that science proceeded with what he called paradigms, and the paradigm at any given point in scientific history, the paradigm defined the way in which that particular science was to proceed. So since we're in the year of Darwin's bicentenary, we could say that evolutionary theory provided a paradigm for biology. Can we call absolute presuppositions paradigms? Are they working in a similar way to the paradigms?
That's a really interesting question, and there's been a lot of discussion about the extent to which Thomas Kuhn would have known about Collingwood's ideas about presuppositions. Had he read Essay on Metaphysics? Did he look at Essay on Philosophical Method? The feeling is that he probably did. Collingwood doesn't use the word paradigm, and by paradigm, Kuhn really means a kind of model solution to a situation. Collingwood talked about what he called constellations of presuppositions that together kind of build up a web of the world, or a way of thinking about the world. Now, he, like Kuhn, believed that these constellations came under strain in not what he would call moments of revolutionary science. They came under strain and they gave way to new constellations of presuppositions. Now, an important difference between Kuhn and Collingwood is that Kuhn often exaggerates the incommensurability between one paradigm, one way of thinking about science, and the one that follows it, whereas Collingwood was quite an Hegelian on this, I think. He believed that the old constellation gave rise to a new one, but an element of the old one was still present in the new one. And he, in arguing this, was drawing upon Hegel's idea of the kind of scale of forms unfolding itself in reality. So the idea of freedom, for example, in one time and age is a good idea of freedom, but it comes under strain, it collapses, is replaced by a new idea of freedom. It's not alienated from that earlier idea of freedom, it's an improvement upon it, a better instantiation. So he's got more of a sense of continuity and perhaps progress to his thinking, his historical thinking, than Kuhn.
I think two things arise from that. One is that it's curious that in the 20th century we get a number of thinkers who proceed in that way, who talk about the suppositions underlying a particular form of inquiry, a particular science. We have Collingwood later on, we have Kuhn, and of course In France, we have Gaston Bachelard, the great French philosopher of science. They're all doing something rather similar, aren't they?
They are indeed, and you could add to the list, of course, Wittgenstein when he's writing on certainty and forms of life. There's an interest, and a kind of historicised interest in that as well, this notion of there being suppositions out there and them changing over time, being part of a kind of wider historicisation of philosophy in the early 20th century. So in a way, Collingwood is a man of his time, despite what he said about himself.
Now, when we're looking at the way in which agents are acting historically in the past, he believes in what he calls reenactment. Now, the notion of reenactment is partly based upon a distinction between an event historically and an action. What's the difference between an event and an action?
An action has thought as its core, and for Collingwood, history is about thought. And if you're simply describing events that have no thought, then that's not history. So for him, history is the history of actions and history of thoughts. And reenactment is the idea that most people would associate with Collingwood, and it's been debated internationally what he meant by the idea. It's a word that's used quite commonly these days, but the way in which it's used is often quite a long way away from the ways in which Collingwood himself explored the notion.
Yes. Now, when we're talking about reenactment, we're not talking about Civil War enthusiasts in the US getting dressed up as Ulysses S. Grant's troops. We're talking about trying to reenact the thought that an agent had in performing an action. First of all, why do we do it? Why is that the way in which we proceed, and what's the alternative? And secondly, how do we do it?
Look, he would have been horrified at the idea of people dressing up in fields. He would have expressed outrage, I'm sure. Why we do it is because Collingwood believes that in understanding the thoughts of others, it's perhaps easier to uncover their absolute presuppositions than it is our own. It's less ticklish to do that. But when we do understand other people's presuppositions, we begin to realise that maybe the grounds on which we stand are also moving. And so why we do it is ultimately to understand ourselves a lot better. So history is really about understanding yourself. And how we do it, well, this is the really big debate. Now, Collingwood didn't believe minds as that they were privacies at all. He believed that reenactment was a moment in which we shared the very same thought. And what he meant by that was we don't share the same thought in terms of numerical or spatial identity, but we share the same concept, and the concept has the same meaning for both of us. And so it's a conceptual view of reenactment that he holds, that if you use the word ouch and I use the word ouch, that we probably have a reasonably good understanding together of the word ouch, and so I understand what you're saying. Now, to get his point across, he uses a couple of interesting examples. He says, in 1912, he says, imagine that somebody plays a note on a harp and then stops playing and then starts playing again. When they play it the second time, is it the same note? And most people would say, yes, of course it is the same note. And then later on in 1935, he says, I write an equation and then I write it again 2 years later. Is it still the same equation? And most people would say, yes, it's the same equation, same letter, same sound. And he's saying, well, why can't the person who lived 200 years ago and the person today have the same thought along the same lines? So it's a really interesting analogy to get to that conclusion. Mm-hmm. And I guess a lot of philosophers would say, oh, gosh, that's not a very complex way of thinking about things. But for the time, it's a really interesting way of thinking about it, and one that's led me to really respect and explore the connections between Collingwood's thinking and Wittgenstein's thinking at the same time. There's this kind of understanding that language is really a key in historical understanding, and shared language and the rules of language are really key for what history is.
On ABC Radio National, you're with the Philosopher's Zone, and I'm talking to Marnie Hughes Warrington, Associate Professor in the Department of Modern History at Macquarie University, about the 20th century English philosopher R.G. Collingwood. Now, thinking more about Collingwood's idea of reenactment, suppose I'm thinking about the Duke of Wellington at the Battle of Waterloo.
Now, Wellington won the battle, and I'm prepared to take a punt and say that that's what he intended to do, that winning the battle was what he wanted to be the outcome. But that doesn't get me very far, does it? So what sort of questions should I be asking?
We should be thinking about historical evidence as language, and he uses that phrase in The Principles of History. I, the historian, read this evidence as saying X. Now, a good historian, he says, not only uses reenactment, but a good historian is never held hostage to what the historical agent would lead him to believe. So if we took Wellington saying his intention is to win X and Y, an historian not only understands the thought of Wellington, but is critical about that and says, OK, my mind is not entirely taken over by the mind of Wellington here. What I do is I critically and autonomously reflect upon his actions, consider the other evidence, and I work out that, you know, he thought about it one way, but actually I think about it quite another way. And this is really interesting because I remember in the 1980s and 1990s, there was a lot of debate in Britain about the role of empathy and reenactment in the national curriculum. And there were huge debates at the time, people were saying, oh, you can't have children reenacting in history classrooms because they'll be taken over by the mind of Stalin and they'll be taken over by the mind of Hitler. And Collingwood made it quite clear that that's not what reenactment is. It's not a form of possession at all. It's always a critical consideration of the presuppositions of another person. It always incorporates a kind of self-reflection upon your own view of what's going on. So we're not held hostage to what that person at that moment thinks. We have a wider view of what's going on.
Although it is interesting if you ask yourself what happens if you reenact the thought of, say, a Stalin. You can't really think of Stalin's thought in terms of intention and consequences. There's an element of the irrational in what Stalin got up to. How do we handle irrationality on the part of agents, which is a big thing in history?
Yes, indeed. And that was a big criticism made about Collingwood at the time. Toynbee thought that Collingwood was too rationalist when he published his writing. And similarly, people have criticised him for excluding the emotions. Now, what's interesting is if you only looked at what he wrote about reenactment in The Idea of History, that's what you'd conclude. But when The Principles of History was found in the 1990s and published, Collingwood made it quite clear that he viewed the emotions and even irrationality is something that we could, in theory, perhaps incorporate into reenactment. Emotions, I think it works well. I think he had quite a conceptual view of the emotions and he viewed them as rational, so he could accommodate that. On irrationality, I think it's more difficult for him, but he doesn't rule it out at all. He's actually quite Crocean in that sense.
This is Benedetto Croce, the great Italian philosopher.
Right. He translated Benedetto Croce's book, What's Living and What's Dead in the Philosophy of Hegel. And Croce always maintained that in a concept or an idea, there was, even if it was not, you know, if it was ugliness, for instance, there was always a tiny speck of beauty, even in ugliness. And I think Collingwood was influenced by that. So even if someone was acting irrationally, there was always a little speck of rationality in there. And he's such an optimist, he thought that maybe he could grab hold of that and use that as an opportunity to get an understanding of what Stalin was perhaps up to. But he would need to use all these other forms of evidence to really get a good understanding of what was going on.
Let's turn to an example of his encounter with something that at first sight he could not understand. And this comes from the autobiography, the Albert Memorial in London, this great Victorian monument, which he passes every day, and he finds indescribably ugly. And this has interesting philosophical consequences for him because it leads him towards his theory of question and answer. But how could anybody have created something as ugly as this? What was he trying to do? That's the question to ask.
Yeah, now the logic of question and answer is a really interesting feature of Collingwood's thought because a lot of people talk about it quite separately as a kind of philosophical technique, that it's a little tool that you use. And analytical philosophers like to view Collingwood in that way. But I think the example that you've given is a better way of thinking about Collingwood's own understanding that this tool, this technique, was something that was put to work in order to understand something that appeared not to be understandable, something so horrific, so alien from what he was thinking, in order to get at the presupposition. So the logic of question and answer is that we ask this chain of questions, we follow the answers. And in a way, this technique allows us to drive down and identify the presuppositions that are shaping what's going on there. Now, the Albert Memorial is a nice example. I can contrast it with an unpublished paper that he wrote on the gramophone, The Evils of the Gramophone. He just was outright horrified that people would reproduce music mechanically, that it would never be as beautiful as the original. And yet, in this other example, later on in his life, he's beginning to put the pieces together and say, actually, this is maybe the place where the historian's work is most needed. When we find, when we encounter things that are so strange to us, we have the best opportunity to understand ourselves a little better and other people too.
So if we think in terms of question and answer, we ask, what is this site that we're digging in? Looks like a fort. Why is there a fort here?
Yeah, exactly right. That's a nice example. Another little one that he gives in the Principles of History is, I find a triangular piece of clay on the ground. It's got a hole in it. I pick it up. I, as an historian, look at the object. I read it and I begin to think it's a loom weight. And I wonder, what's a loom weight doing in the ground when there are these other objects here? Why would a loom weight be here? What activities are people engaging in? Who's engaging in those activities? So there's an endless chain of questions that's leading me back to understand not only the economic activities that are going on, but also the ways in which people are thinking about the world. That's ultimately what he's looking for, is how are people understanding the world at that time, all from the basis of a little triangular piece of clay.
The history of philosophy, certainly in England in the 20th century, we begin, I suppose, with the logical endeavours of Bertrand Russell. We then have a bit of input from Vienna. We have the logical positivists for whom the natural sciences are really where the important action is. And then we have linguistic philosophy in the second half of the century, looking at the ideas presupposed in our language. That world looks very differently, does it, if you look at it through the eyes of Collingwood, whose focus is far more historical than any of these people's focus?
Yeah, indeed. He wrote one of the little things in the Principles of History that's most amusing to read is a little satirical piece called Philosophy in Legado. It's a kind of take on Gulliver's Travels, where he travels to this little island and there's a group of philosophers who are talking about the idea of beauty and things like that. And what they're doing is they're measuring physically the idea of beauty by their weight and by their head size and all of this thing. And what he's driving at is that these approaches to philosophy miss the point horribly. He thinks it's right that philosophy at that time described itself as scientific, and that for him is a first-order way of thinking about the world. It's not philosophy, it is scientific activity, and it really gloriously misses the point. And if we want to understand the world, we have to move beyond kind of analytical approaches to philosophy and the kind of positive approaches to philosophy as well. What's really interesting is that, of course, a lot of commentators after Collingwood's death read him analytically and, in fact, lament that Collingwood wasn't better analytically. If he'd only just got his concept clear, he would have been a better philosopher. And you think, well, no, that's not, I think, the way he was trying to approach things. It was a different way of viewing things, yeah.
Marnie Hughes Warrington. And to hear us again, you can go to our website at abc.net.au/rn/philosopherszone, which is also the place to go for our archive, every zone since 2006. The show's produced by Kyla Slaving, with technical production by Charlie McCune. I'm Alan Saunders, and I'll be back next week with another Philosopher's Zone.
On Future Tense, two leading thinkers of the online world, Jeff Jarvis and Chris Anderson, share their thoughts on the way companies should adapt to the rapidly changing online environment and the current economic crisis. Both believe traditional businesses could do well to adapt aspects of the online approach to innovation and management. Find out why on Future Tense. With me, Anthony Fennell. Download or stream this program from the Radio National website.